My name is Winnie Eddy. I'm the wife of an alcoholic, a member of Al-Anon, but I'm not always grateful for either one. I'm delighted to be here in Fort Wayne. It's always nice to talk in a place you don't have to make amends to. And fortunately for you, you were not on Route 66, so I missed you. But I would like to thank Jan and the committee for inviting me to come to Fort Wayne. Now that I know where it is, I'll be back. And I can hardly wait to get home to tell His Lordship that Klaus paid me a beautiful compliment at the airport. When my luggage arrived, you know, I had said to him, just because you see this suitcase, don't think that I'm moving to Fort Wayne, because that's what I usually look like. And when I only had two bags, he said, is that all you have? And I said, yes. And then he tried to pick them up. So you can't always go by what you think you see. Anyhow, I am very happy to be here. I'm always happy to be wherever I am. You know, that's where the inside job takes place, as far as I'm concerned. Because wherever I am, I can be comfortable. And it wasn't always that way. It wasn't that I even knew that I was uncomfortable. That's the sad part of the story. I thought all of you were uncomfortable, and I was the only one that was trying to save the world. So it's no wonder that I didn't come to Al-Anon for any of the good reasons. I didn't come because I wanted it, because I needed it, or even because I thought that it could help me. I only came because I'm married to a nut, and he decided to go into the hospital and do something about his drinking, despite the help I had been giving him. And one of the conditions was that he attend AA meetings. Now, at an AA meeting, he heard about Al-Anon. And it has always been a mystery to me why, while everybody else was making wallets and moccasins, he took the time to sit down and write a letter to the Al-Anon Central Office in Los Angeles and tell those complete strangers that there was something wrong with me. And when I got here, I didn't stay for the good reasons either. I didn't stay because I liked it. I didn't like it. And I didn't like it to the point that I tried to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I took their 20 questions test and I flunked it. So I went to the guy I thought was the big shot in our particular area. He was the one that always got the chair with the seat in it. Because contrary to the way meeting rooms and Alana clubs are furnished today, when I came into Al-Anon, they used to furnish them with rejects from the Goodwill. And if you didn't hit your bottom before you got there, you did shortly thereafter. Because none of the darn things had any springs in them, but this guy always got the chair that kind of held up. It looked sort of like a throne. And I figured he had to be at least a supervisor. So I went to him one day and I confessed. I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And he said, what makes you think so? Well, I said, I flunked your test. Oh, he said, if you flunked that test, chances are you are an alcoholic. When did you have your last drink? Well, I said, I think it was about 3 years ago. And he said, lady, if it's been 3 years ago and you got to think about it, go back over with those women and let them help you. Now, I have no idea what shape you were in when you got to this fellowship, but I want you to know at that particular time, being rejected by Alcoholics Anonymous didn't do a lot for me. And when I went back over with those women, I went with one thing in mind. I wanted to get them to help me get even with them. That was sort of my way of life. See, I was always recruiting these people to help me get even with those people. And pretty soon these people became those people. It was a very busy time. But I stayed for another reason, too, though. There happened to be one female in that group that was just the nastiest woman I had ever come in contact with. And I decided to out-sit her. It wasn't so much what she said to me, because she never said anything. But she'd look at me and she'd go, and I didn't know what that meant. And she knitted, which almost drove me up a wall, because I don't knit. And when you're perfect and you don't knit, you're in big trouble. But I didn't even begin to believe I was sick which is one of the first things they told me, until I started to like her. And then I went immediately to my sponsor and I told her, I said, I think I'm beginning to like her. And Wilma had one answer for every situation. It's all right. I could have told her I shot my husband and she'd say, it's all right. And I said, well, it really isn't. And she wanted to know why, and I told her. I said, I have never changed my mind about anyone. And that was the truth. You see, I put people in categories, those you encouraged, those you tolerated, and those you ignored. And once I had you placed, you had to stay there because I didn't know how to shuffle you around. And I realized today I probably deprived myself of a lot of very meaningful relationships because of my inability to allow people to be whatever they want to be. Now, I know there are some alcoholics in the group tonight, and if you don't mind, I always like to give them their message first. Well, you know how they are. And truth of the matter is, I'm not even sure I got a message for them, but I talked out in Fontana one night, which is a little town east of where I live, and it hadn't been one of my better days. So it really surprised me when this woman came up and she said, where are you going to be the next time? And I said, well, I'm not really sure. Why? Well, she said, I'd just love to have my husband hear you, which made me think I must have said something profound, but I couldn't remember what it was. And, you know, you might need it. So I asked her. I said, do you think I could help your husband? Well, she said, not really, but after he hears you, he's going to be glad he got me. So, that may be the only message they get, but I want you to know it works in Alateen, too. I've sent a lot of kids home, very grateful. I only have one story, and I don't apologize for it anymore because there is no way I can change what I used to be like. But what I can do today, thanks to places like this and people like you, is use those so-called unhappinesses of the past as a stepping stone into a better way to live today. So for the next few minutes, I'm going to share a little experience, strength, and hope, and tell you a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened. And in my particular case, I let you guess. Because there's people in Al-Anon still don't think I'm going to make it. And that's okay. See, because that's one of the things I learned in rooms just like this. It really doesn't bother me how much they worry about me until I begin to worry about them worrying about me. That's when I get into all the trouble. I grew up in a family where there's a drinking problem, and I even used to say that my father was an alcoholic. But who knows? I don't know today. He didn't think he was. He thought he was a social drinker. So he lived a social drinker, and he died a social drinker. But he liked it. And when I wasn't helping him, he liked me too. But when I came to Al-Anon, I could spot an alcoholic 2 miles away. Anybody that was going into a bar, coming out of a bar, standing in front of a liquor store, or just looking strange. To me, it was an alcoholic. That's what I was accustomed to. Strange people. Never knew where they came from, but they always ended up next door to me. I was always surrounded by weirdos, you know? Now, in growing up, it wasn't what my father did that bothered me. It's what he wouldn't do that bothered me. You see, I happened to be a born researcher. And at a very early age, I started researching fathers. Now, this takes a little footwork because you got to cover the neighborhood and watch the fathers. Then I would come home and look at mine. He never did any of the things he was supposed to do. And I made some suggestions, but I was raised in a hard-headed Irish family, and my father wouldn't take direction from a 4 or 5, 6-year-old, whatever I happened to be at the time. So right then is when I set a pattern to my life that lasted till I got to Al-Anon. I got even. I ignored him. And you better believe my ignoring him made my life more miserable than all his drinking could have done if he'd have been drinking at me. Because when I was away at school, I could be honest about my mother, my brothers, and my sister, but never my father. See, I used to describe him the way he should be, which made life very difficult because it meant nobody could go home with me. If they did, they were going to find out one of two things right now. The man that was living with my mother was not my father. Or that I was the biggest liar that ever came down the pike. Now, I never considered myself a liar. I looked upon myself as a diplomat. Because I didn't lie, I just didn't tell the truth. And I thought there was a difference. You see, I learned at a very early age, people anticipate what you're going to say. So you just lead them up to a certain point and stop. They guess what you would have said if you'd have gone on, see? But they're very poor guessers. However, I never felt I should be held responsible for their inadequacies. And I have trouble with that even sometimes today, because since my husband has been sober and taken an interest in my welfare, which is just a nice way of saying he don't tell me to drop dead as often as he used to, but if I'm going someplace that's quite a ways away, he usually volunteers to go with me. Now, this, at least for me, is a test of serenity. Because I happen to be married to the original. Don't know where he's going when he leaves. He don't know where he is when he gets there. And usually he don't know where he's been when he gets back. But if he goes with me, he directs me every step of the way, you know. And we're at opposite ends of the pole when it comes to being anything alike. Because I happen to be married to a thinker. Yeah, sometimes he thinks 2-3 weeks before he answers you, you know. It really isn't as bad as it sounds. It's a marvelous memory course because you have to keep in mind everything you've been talking about, see? Because when he comes up with the answer, he never connects it to anything, you know. He just says yes. Well, I'll give you a better example. Since he's given up drinking, he's taken up dusting, and that's almost as bad as drinking. But we happened to be playing golf one day, and I just kind of looked over, and here he is, dusting the golf cart with my sweater. And I took rather exception to it, so when I got back in the cart, I merely said to him, "When you die, I'm going to bury you in a plastic bag." And he didn't say anything, so I didn't say anything. But about 2 weeks later, I thought we were having a friendly cup of coffee, really. And all of a sudden, he said, "I don't think that was very nice." I guess he thought it over and he didn't like the bag idea, I guess. But on the other hand, I'm one of those people that reacts immediately. You know, I try to get it done before I really know what you want me to do. And when you put two people like that in one automobile, you have a little problem. Because if we're going down the freeway and he says, "Turn right," I turn right now. And he says, "Not here." I'm about 60 miles too soon. So on this particular night that I'm going to tell you about, I had been asked to come down to Chula Vista, which is down close to San Diego. And I was having a moment of growth. Or whatever you want to call it, I just knew I wasn't well enough to go that far with him without running over him. But I didn't want to tell him. I didn't want him to go, see, because he gets hurt so easy, and then he mopes around, and I make all those amends. God, I don't even know what I've done. And I just didn't want to get involved. So I just said, "Eddie, I'm going to a meeting." And he said, "Okay," and I left. But that night I didn't get home at 10:30 or 10:45. It was closer to 1:45. And when I walked through the door, there he stood, right in my spot. with that age-old question, "Where the hell have you been?" And without even thinking, I said, "Well, how far do you think it is to Chula Vista?" Now, he accused me of lying to him. I didn't lie to him. I didn't tell him I wasn't going to Chula Vista. And if he had said, "Winnie, are you going to Chula Vista?" I was going to say yes. Are you getting the picture? Yeah, if you were bright enough to ask the right question, you got the whole story. But if you weren't, you got stuck with what you thought. And I might add, that'll get you into a little trouble occasionally also. My dad did have one habit, kind of slopped over into later years, and that was sleeping on the living room floor. He never really liked it, but it was the way it worked out, you know. He'd come home and he'd sit down, then he'd lean down, then he'd lay down. And It was a pretty good indication he was good for the night, and my mother was one of those people that let me understand that's his business. You tend to your business, we'll have no problems. So I used to step over him and go about my business. But what I should have done was step on him. He bothered me on that living room floor. And when I got one of my own, they used to pick peculiar places to sleep. I didn't care if he was on the porch, the lawn. I always had kind of a fondness for the freeway, really, because... Well, Eddie had a double indemnity clause in his insurance. That was one of the first games we ever played. I kept paying the premiums. He took vitamins with his beer. It was... But I couldn't stand him on the living room floor. And I can remember right to this minute, you know, taking him by the heels, and I'd pull him, and his head bound. I loved it when his head bound. There was something about that thud that just made me feel good deep down inside, you know. Because I wanted to hurt him the way I thought he was trying to hurt me. And drunk as he was, you know, he'd say, "You're not mad at me, you're mad at your father." You know? And of course, I had a standard answer for that. Compared to you, my father was a Boy Scout. Now, the tragedy of that is that that's the way it worked. You see, not too awfully long ago, there was a little girl in the group that I call a home group, or as close to a home group as I have, and she was about up to here with him. And she either paused or took a breath or something, but very quietly I leaned over and I said to her, "Honey, that wouldn't have bothered me at all." And she looked at me like I'd crawled out from underneath a rock. And she said, "And why wouldn't it have bothered you?" And I said, "Because it was your husband." And you see, that was the story of my life. When my husband's drinking began to bother me, or his attitude, really, my father did become a Boy Scout, because I was far enough removed from it that the old tapes left and the good things came back. I was always comparing one with the other. I don't really know what happened to the man that I met, fell in love with, and permitted to marry me, but as soon as he was mine, I decided to help him. I just wanted to help him become what I was sure he wanted to be for my sake. And I'm not well enough yet to define that for you, but I'll tell you something I didn't tell him, and that is that my help is deadly. I had friends that wouldn't even tell me they were in trouble for fear I'd help them, you know. Because I had that knack for lousing things up. But Eddie and I, of course, when we got married, we ceased to be friends. We became competitors. He spent his life trying to outwit me while I spent my life trying to outwit him. And when we finally got here, we were a couple of half-wits. But he was in the Navy. He was a professional man, full lieutenant. And I didn't go into this blindly. I did a little research job on the Navy. And unfortunately for them, I came across the table of operations. And I just happened to notice that there was only a couple of lines between what he was and what I decided to help him become, which was admiral. I knew they only had one admiral in the dental corps, but I only had one man in mind for the job. It didn't look as difficult as it turned out to be, but had I been halfway bright, I would have joined the Navy myself, because I showed up every day. He only showed up when the spirit moved him. And I'd have made a pretty good shore patrolman, too, because I have just a little bit of bird dog in me, and when I'd show up and find out he hadn't made it, I'd just put my nose to the ground, and away I'd go. And sooner or later, I always found him, but usually by that time, he was in no shape for me to let anybody else find him. And so that's when I used to hide him. Actually, we played hide-and-seek for years, and he didn't know there was a game going on at the time, but... After he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt I should help him with the program because I wasn't sure he was bright enough to get what they said they wanted to give him. So I went to every meeting, and I had a little notebook, and I would jot down a few of the pertinent things that applied to his peculiar case, and then I'd sort of spoon-feed it to him during, well, you know, if they had another examination, I wanted the dummy to pass. And I heard two things at those meetings that are worse than drinking. Lots of things are worse than drinking. Sobriety, for instance. Now, I can only speak for myself, but it was always easier for me to watch Eddie throw up than grow up. It just worked out that way. But one of the things I heard was sleep teaching. I got myself a big AA book, and every night, just as he dozed off, I would open it to chapter 5, and I would read to him. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It was a beautiful reading. Emphasis on the proper words, everything. In fact, I memorized the whole fifth chapter. But dummies slept through the whole damn thing. And I still think it's the reason when we go to an AA meeting outside our own area, where when you walk in, people don't really know which one's which. It is always me they come up to. They say, keep coming back, honey. It'll work. Yeah, I think I'm the drunk. But anyhow, the other thing I heard was you can't get drunk if you're grateful. Now, right after I got to Al-Anon, they took away from me some of my finer phrases, such as, you had better not be drunk tonight. If I smell liquor on your breath, your clothes will be on the porch. My neighbors, of course, thought I was some kind of a fresh air nut. I put them out every night, put them in every morning, you know. But they wouldn't let me do that or say that, so I had to find some way to get this message across. And so when I heard that bit about gratitude, I just latched right onto it. Every morning when Eddie left for the office, I'd say, now remember, today we're going to be grateful. And he'd say, for what? So I used to give him things to be grateful for, but I wasn't really all that grateful myself at that particular time. So without even realizing it, I think I started one of the first gratitude lists for him. I jotted down a few things he should be grateful for, starting with myself, of course. And while I was doing that, I happened to remember this game of hide and seek. So one morning I explained to him, because I'm a great explainer. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but I was never able to say yes or no. I had to give you a detailed explanation. Sometimes I was so convincing, I changed my mind right in the middle, you know. It was almost frustrating. But I'm not much better in that today either, you know. The example I usually use is my wristwatch. I always wanted a watch with a little teeny-weeny tiny face, something that would kind of reflect my personality. And as soon as my eyes got bad, Eddie bought me one, you know, naturally. The timing is perfect. And I complained about it so much that he got me another one, kind of about that size with a band. And in my enthusiasm, I pulled the stem out. But Lord, I didn't want him to think I was abusing his gifts. So I fixed it myself, which is an advantage. You know, most of us Al-Anons can fix anything. Don't always work, but it don't look bad, you know. Anyhow, I kind of looked out with that watch, and I happened to be up in Kanab, Utah, and some poor unsuspecting Utahn, noticing I had a watch, asked me what time it was. Well, I had to tell him about the watch with a little teeny-weeny face and getting the big one and pulling out the stem and fixing it myself, and it gains 5 minutes every 24 hours. I've had it 3 years. Now, there's an hour difference between Kanab and California, and I finally figured it out, and I looked up, and the man was gone. And it really kind of shook me up, you know, because I felt like 007 talking to my wristwatch on corner in Kanab, Utah. But not very many people ask me anything anymore. But Eddie, of course, was a hostage, so I did explain to him that when he drank excessively, it had been necessary for me on occasion to hide him. And I had put him in some rather out-of-the-way places, but I'd never lost him. So be grateful. And I did put him in some strange places, and the one that I always tell about happened down at the Long Beach Naval Station, and I tell it primarily because it points out a lot of things about me. They used to have a mock submarine just inside the sentry gate, and one morning I came across Lloyd John in front of that mock submarine with his six-pack of beer at the exact moment that I spotted his commanding officer coming from the opposite direction. Now, I had just told that man one of my better stories, which meant I had to get rid of him. I mean, you can understand he was living proof that I hadn't told the whole story. However, the only place I had to put him was in that sub. Now, it might also help you a little bit if you knew that when I came to Al-Anon, I had one of the greatest pitching arms in the world. I could throw a full six-pack of beer farther than he had strength enough to retrieve it. So if I was around and he had a six-pack of beer, he'd hold it like I was going to take it away from him, you know. Well, getting him in that sub is not as hard as it sounds. I just helped him up and he fell down. He didn't know where he was going. But getting him out. Now, that is a whole other story. He didn't trust me, so he wouldn't hand me the beer. And I have many times since wondered what that sentry must have thought of that female. half in, half out of the conning tower of that damn submarine, finally coming up with this lieutenant commander holding his beer in his hat. He thought he'd been torpedoed right in the middle of Long Beach, you know, because he didn't know where he was. And I used to worry about that sentry, because I used to go on that base like I owned it in my housecoat and my curlers. I don't really think the alcoholic appreciates what we give up in order to help them. In my particular case, it was dressing. I had a choice. I could always go to bed in whatever I was going to wear the next day, but I just don't think you have that comfortable feeling you get with one of them old house coats. You know, mine happened to be a chenille number, and it sort of had double duty, you know. I used to pluck it while I planned. It looked almost like lace when I finally got rid of it, but anyhow, I'm sure you can understand how I felt when Eddie came home and announced he had resigned from the Navy. I was like somebody that had lost a business. Because I had started to wonder about him. Now, that part is true. But I never blamed the drinking. I didn't want my husband to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and quit drinking. I wanted him to learn to mind. But see, I never objected to him having a drink. Sometimes I allowed him to. And there were times when maybe three were called for. But there was a strangeness about this man that I just could not understand. It seemed like one drink and he was set in cement. I couldn't do anything with him. And I don't know how many times I said to him, when we are invited to a cocktail party on Friday, we can come home on Friday. We don't have to stay till Monday, you know. And I think one of my confusions stemmed from the fact that I liked those cocktail parties. See, I like that nice, easy social life in the service. And I didn't even mind making a fool out of myself. Occasionally. But he was making a career out of it. And I didn't understand it. But as his drinking increased, mine decreased. It became more important for me to know where he was, who he was with, where he was going, how they were going to get there, or what was he thinking. Have you ever tried to read somebody's mind through their eyeballs when their lids are at half-mast? It's not easy, you know. And when I first got to Al-Anon, my sponsor took me to a lot of AA meetings because there weren't near the number of Al-Anon meetings available that there are today. And as I was saying earlier at dinner, you don't take somebody of my caliber into an AA meeting without there being some kind of trouble. You know, because they all needed me. They were so stupid I couldn't believe it. You know, and some of them were doctors, some of them were lawyers, but they were stupid. And I tried to help them, but they had a nasty way of saying, sit down, shut up, and listen, you know. But they also talked about the first drink, the first drink, first drink. And I don't know how many of them I told. It is not the first drink. But I couldn't remember whether it was the second or the third or the fourth. But see, I wasn't trying to figure out what alcohol did to him. I was trying to figure out where I lost control. And I got so bad about it that one night on the way home, my sponsor said to me, Winnie, don't help them, let them suffer. And by that time, I was mad at most of them, so I quit helping them. But God has a way of working in my life, and he takes his time about it, too. But he finally got me to an AA meeting one night where the man talked almost exclusively on the first drink. And after the meeting, Eddie and I ran into him in the coffee shop, which is to say we got into the same coffee shop, and I spotted him. And I said, I think I'll run over there and tell that man that if he intends to talk at a public level, he should be a little more factual. Now, I like to give the devil his due. My husband has never deprived me of making as big a jackass out of myself as I want to. And so he just sat there while I traced across the coffee shop, sat down with this complete stranger, and picked his talk apart. He happened to be a railroad man from Texas, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, that I scared the hell out of him because he had sort of a glazed look in his eyes for almost a full minute, you know. But when he finally got his voice back, he said to me, well, honey, let me put it to you this way. When you get killed by a train, it weren't the caboose that did it. And I haven't had any trouble with the first drink since. It's because I understand trains. I know about trains. It's alcoholism that I don't understand, and I'll never understand it, because I'm not an alcoholic. And what appears to be nonsense to me is a life and death matter. to them. And so I quit trying to figure out what it's all about. I just remember that when you get hit by a train, it weren't the caboose that did it. But I was still a long way from Al-Anon. I thought a good wife was responsible for making something out of what she'd gotten stuck with. So I started trying to figure out, you know, what I'm going to do with him. And I happened to remember his mother. Now, I never liked his mother. I didn't really have any reason not to like her, except she was his mother. And the fact that I didn't like her is no big deal either. There were lots of people I didn't like. Whole towns, in fact. But she was sort of strange. She didn't believe in drinking anything but water. So, being intelligent as I am, it dawned on me that probably Eddie's problem stemmed from the fact that he had not been raised in a social drinking family such as mine. Therefore, he just didn't know how to drink. So I decided to teach him. Have you ever tried to teach a drunk how to drink? Well, you got one problem. You got to get him sober enough to find out if he's learning anything that you're teaching him. So in order to do that, I decided to get him out of California. I hated California. To me, it was one large bar separated by an occasional liquor store. And I decided to bring him back here to the Middle West, where people are really people, which is where I'm from. And that decision lasted, well, until I got to Gallup, New Mexico. I spent 3 miserable days there just because I made a teeny-weeny mistake. I stopped. And he got away from me. And in fact, he got into a bar I was afraid to follow him into, because from where I was sitting, he and a tribe of Indians went in. And I know all about what they did, you know, fire water. And I wasn't going to let them get me. And I didn't care if they got him. So I just sat outside and waited. Never dawned on me there was a back door. He just went in the front door and out the back door. Wherever he wanted to go, in the back door, out the front door, and Old Faithful was always spouting right where he left her. And I always like to mention the little Indian gal that was standing in front of that place, because I think she was my first contact with that very special something that I feel I have found in Al-Anon. In AA, they call it the unspoken language. But in Al-Anon, at least for me, I think it's the language of the heart. This is the only place in my life that I have ever been when I can feel what somebody else is saying. Or I can watch some guy or gal walk in for the first time and I don't have to know who they are, where they came from, what their husband does, what kind of a car do they drive, how many children do they have. I don't need statistics. All I do is look in their eyes. And when I see in their eyes that same, there ain't nobody home here look that I've seen in my eyes, I know where they've been. But you know, looking over at that little Indian that first morning, I was so embarrassed for her that she would allow herself to be degraded by standing in front of that place. While I am across the street making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for 5 children, she looked strange to me. Second day, she looked pretty good, but the third day kind of eyed her, you know, because she had her side of the street and I had mine. And if you've ever been to Gallup, New Mexico, that's all it is, 2 sides of the street. And we had them both covered. But I had to make one of my many decisions, and I decided that I would never again stop where the human race could contaminate my husband. Now, if you happen to be driving across country in an automobile and you don't intend to stop, you must make adjustments. And some dummy told me that Texas had dry counties, so that's the adjustment I made. I had taken a course in navigation when Eddie was in the Navy to improve him, his record, you know. So I just mapped out a course. I never stopped unless I was in a dry county. Well, it didn't help a whole lot. He got just as drunk in a dry one as he would have been a wet one. But when you're going crazy on a slow, easy plan, this will help you. You can spend hours wondering, where did he get it? I don't know where they get it, but I'll tell you something I do know. I could have buried him and he'd come up drunk. I don't know. I don't know where they get it. But my kids think Texas is the biggest place on earth because it took us almost 2 weeks to get through it. And it was kind of an unwritten law as far as those kids were concerned. If she stops and you got anything to do, get out, get it done, and get back. She'll never miss you. And that's pretty much the way it was. I concentrated on that seat. And if it was full, we went. And if it was empty, we waited. Very simple way of life. Of course, God alone knows how much travel time we lost when he got in the back by mistake and never looked back there. That is not where he is supposed to be. And I could depend on those kids. They wouldn't have said anything because one of their favorite sayings was, don't upset her. But used to upset me. Now, all I'm offering tonight is my opinion, how I think and how I feel. But I don't think my kids reacted to the alcoholic. My kids reacted to my reaction to the alcoholic. Because it's true, Eddie came home drunk lots of times. And he did very strange things. But they knew he was drunk. They knew he was strange. How do you explain me? I am running the group. And I don't know where I am half the time. You know, I had one kid, our number two son. I couldn't keep that kid in school to save my soul. I'd take him to school, he'd be waiting for me when I got home, you know. And after he got to go to Alateen and I got to go to Al-Anon and we got to where we could talk as people instead of God and the little child, which is the way it had been, I asked him one day, I said, why wouldn't you go to school, Billy? Didn't you like school? He says, yeah, I really did, Mom. But I was afraid you'd move while I was gone. And that can be a real key to a little kid. I didn't know until just a couple of years ago, my kids had a formula for me. If she puts her shoes on, she's going out. But if she gets dressed, we're moving. The way it worked. Anyhow, I guess I should tell you I have 8 children altogether. Usually I make you count them as they creep in just like I did. I was always surprised. And I might add that Eddie was a little shocked when he sobered up too. He thought I was babysitting for a living. But that's his story. I try not to get into it. I probably have the only set of twins on earth that ever had to be explained, you know, because when I left California, I knew I was expecting a baby, but I always lived on a schedule. You know, make the beds at 7 o'clock, which ain't easy because they don't get up till 8, but all of these other impossible things, and if you have 5 children, having a baby's no big deal, but I had ended up in Kansas. I set up a beautiful dental office, had patients, had everything, no dentist, and it was getting a little bit close to the time, so I went up to Kansas City to see this doctor, and whether you realize it or not, doctors are very happy people. Most of them are just glad you're sick. This one, however, he was the joy boy of the world, you know. You should have seen him. He helped me in, sat me down, then he patted me on the head. He said, Mrs. Eddie, you're going to have twins. Well, I almost died in his office because I wasn't really counting on one. He was insisting on 2. And I had problems. I had that dental office, no dentist, plus 5, and that thing I didn't know what to do with. And besides all that, I knew what Eddie was going to say when I told him, because he said it. There are no twins in my family. I got so involved defending my moral character that I forgot there were twins in my family. It wasn't until they arrived and my mother said, isn't it nice we have another set of twins? I said, in whose family? She said, ours. I said, well, why didn't you tell me? She said, you never asked me. No big deal. I never ask anybody anything. Can you think of a better way for people to find out you don't know something than to ask them? You know, even when I used to get lost, I'd pull into a filling station and I would say to the attendant, where are you located? Because I knew if I found out where he was, I'd know where I was. And he wouldn't ever know I didn't know. That was what was important, you know. And, of course, at the appointed time, I went into the hospital. And here again, hospitals are happy places also. People are happy they got there. Some are happy. Everybody's happy. I had been happy once. It hadn't worked out well. So I didn't really want what they had. And as soon as I could, I had a phone put in. And if I thought I was getting happy, I'd just pick up that phone and call the office. Now, I knew Eddie wasn't going to answer that phone. I wasn't even sure he knew I'd put a phone in there. But the point I'm trying to make is, I don't need him to make me miserable, or you, or them out there. All I have to have is a little time to think, to wonder, where is he? And who is he with? And what are they doing? 15 minutes, that's all it takes. You're having a start, you haven't even had a visitor. You look like you've been run over by a truck, you know. Because I never thought of my husband being out with the boys. There's no fun in that. Mine was always out with the girls. Those pretty sweet, lovable things you find in them damn dirty bars, you know. The ones that look like me before he did this. And if you like to be right and you're anything like me, find a mirror. You look like something was left over from a bad Halloween party. Because being a martyr is not easy. That's a 24-hour-a-day concentrated effort, or you don't get the look. See, you gotta have circles down to here, preferably with bags. Tear stains, you get kind of worn in. And then if you play it right, you know, follow the formula. Lots of cigarettes, plenty of coffee, and positively no sleep. That's when you get the big one. That's sort of a twitch. That you don't know where it comes from, you know? Well, can you imagine giving up all of that for this? That's what I had to do. As I told you in the beginning, it was a letter that my husband wrote that got me to Al-Anon, and tonight, as I have been many other nights, I'm grateful that he cared enough to want to share that very special something that he felt he had found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I also want to thank God, as I understand him, that he sent me a sponsor who had the patience of Job. Because I wasn't an easy nut to crack. You had to catch me first. And when Wilma came the first afternoon, she found the front door nailed shut. Now, that was really necessary, though. I was in no shape to cover two doors. I was absolutely pooped. And she was undaunted. She went around to the back, and the car was in the driveway, and the coffee pot was boiling on the stove, and she used me, but she couldn't find me. So she went next door, and she asked this little old lady whether or not Mrs. Eddie was at home. And you know what the woman said? Even if she is... She thought I was crazy. And I resented that. You know, I never bothered that woman. I didn't like her, see? And once we did almost get trapped in the backyard together, but I hid in the bushes till she went in. I didn't want to talk to her. You know. And my kids didn't bother her either. I didn't forbid them to go over there because I've always felt forbidding children to do things leave scars. So I used just a little psychology, you know, tell them the story of Hansel and Gretel and let them make up their own mind. You want to end up in an oven, there's where you go. But she scared Wilma, and when she came back that night, she had a friend with her, and I don't know to this day how she got in. I used to ask her, but it upset her, so I had to quit. But I used to get my kids to bed on a production basis, you know, everybody in the tub, everybody washed, rinsed out, dried, dressed in bed, so mother can worry. And Wilma came between the drying and the dressing process. I had all these little naked running around. Now, make up their own mind. You want to end up in an oven, there's where you go. But she scared Wilma, and when she came back that night, she had a friend with her. And I don't know to this day how she got in. I used to ask her, but it upset her, so I had to quit. But I used to get my kids to bed on a production basis. You know, everybody in the tub, everybody washed, rinsed out, dried, dressed in bed, so mother can worry. And Wilma came between the drying and the dressing process. I had all these little naked bodies running around. Hell, I couldn't hide them. I couldn't even catch them, you know. And Wilma never even hesitated. She just picked up a towel and she dried and she talked. Alcoholics, Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon family groups. Then she said the magic word, drunks, and I knew why she was there. She needed me. She said she needed me. She told me that I had survived something that I didn't even know I had, that a whole lot of other people had, that we were going to get together and help them as a group. Now, that's what it sounded like. But when she left that night, whatever she had brought in with her went out with her. I gave her just time enough to get home, and then I called and told her that something very important had come up and I would be unable to attend the meeting she was scheduling. Now, I hadn't even done anything unimportant for a long time, but I couldn't let her know that. I couldn't let her find out how unimportant I thought I was, and that should have been the first chink in the armor. Should have been the first time I began to realize, I never hid from you, I hid from me. Because a long time ago, probably farther back than I'd ever be able to remember, I got that crazy idea that I didn't measure up to what I thought you thought I ought to be. And so I built a wall. And that wall was supposed to keep you from finding out how truly inadequate I thought I was. But the sad part of the story is, I'm the one that got lost behind the wall. When I came to Al-Anon, I didn't laugh, I didn't cry, I didn't care. I knew it had to end. I just wanted it to hurry. But you know, even a defect of character can put you in good stead. I had told this woman I would help her, and I didn't want to be beholding, so 2 weeks later, I went to my first meeting in Azusa, California. And I hope and pray on a daily basis that I never, ever forget that night. I don't ever want to be an old-timer in this way of life, because I was an old-timer when I got here. But I want to remember each and every day what it felt like to walk from a world of absolute chaos into a place of absolute peace, where nobody asked me who I was, where my husband was, what my husband did. How many children do you have? Just the fact that I was there seemed to be number one on the agenda. But when you're suspicious, like I was, you don't get taken in that easy. I took as much of the free literature as I could take without looking interested. And then I borrowed a book because I didn't want to get financially involved. And I went home and I studied. I memorized the steps. I even memorized the tradition. And I waited 24 hours before I complained. And when I called Wilma, I said, I don't feel any better. I told her how I had worked. I said, in fact, I'm still in the playpen. And she said, you're where? And I said, in the playpen. Well, of course, you see, my sponsor doesn't have any children. But if you have 8 children and you want to study, that's the best place for you. You don't even have to wonder where the kids are. They're sitting outside watching you to see what you're going to do next, you know. But I guess she figured I was ripe or ready or something, because she said to me, you know, we don't have to memorize the steps. We have to work them. And I knew I'd gotten a sick sponsor. Because in all that reading, and even today, in all that literature, there's not one direction. There's not a formula. There's not a test. It's just a bunch of words. That's all. And she did make a mistake, too. She said, we use the same steps in Al-Anon that they used to not use in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the way I work them. You see, I'm not powerless over alcohol. I can take it or leave it alone. If it hadn't been for him, I would have managed beautifully. So I figured that must be his step, so I left it for him. The second one also had an unfortunate word. It said, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Now, even an idiot knows if you're going to be restored, you've got to be nuts to begin with. And I wasn't, but I was pretty sure he was, so I left that one for him, too. Of course, I had to go back to that one, because my sponsor made me get a little bit honest, you know, about some of the things I had done. And I used to have some really nasty things I used to pull on Eddie, you know, like, for instance, hiding his car. I'd go pick up his car and I'd put it in the one place I knew he'd never look for it, the garage. And then I'd watch him while he went all over town looking for that darn car, you know, and when I thought he had been punished enough, then I would sneak it out of the garage and put it right back where I'd gotten it from. Now, maybe that isn't crazy, but the pleasure that I used to get out of listening to him mumble, I know I look fair. That's crazy, you know. But when it came to the third step, I skipped that one for both of us. It asked me to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. Well, I understood him. He did not understand me. And I really didn't hate Eddie enough to turn him over, so I skipped that one for both of us. Now, I wasn't going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, but I always gave it to anybody else on earth, whether they asked for it or not. And the example I usually use is our L.A. freeways. See, when I get on the freeway, I go right over to the left-hand lane because that goes straight ahead and that's where I'm going. For some reason, and I've never been able to figure out why, there's always some stinker will come right on behind me, rush past me, move over, and slow down. Which means I gotta get over here, get ahead of him, move back over, and slow down. So he will know how I feel. You know. So he gets ahead of me, and then I get ahead of him, and he gets ahead of me, get ahead of him. About 5 miles up the road, he puts on his right-hand blinker, moves over, and leaves the freeway. Because he's home. I am 3 miles past my turn. Because he has had control of my life. But I wasn't going to turn it over to God. However, I did notice when I would call my sponsor with little situations, you know, and she'd say, well, just turn it over. But she never said to whom, and I can understand that. This is an anonymous program, and you just don't bandy around who handles the problems, you know. But on this particular day, I thought I had a big enough one to complain about, so I called her, had just really gotten started, and I realized she was having a bad day because she said to me, Winnie, turn it over. And I said, you know, you don't have to get that uppity. I'm sure you don't realize you have never said to whom. Well, she said, I thought you knew. You turn it over to God. I said, not me. I haven't even told him I'm going to Al-Anon yet. I am. Because I had a lot of trouble with that, you see. Eddie was having trouble with it, too. I happened to be a good Catholic married to a Methodist. And for years, I thought I was doing penance, you know. And so I was really confused about this turning things over to God. But I realized it was making Wilma unhappy. And I didn't want her to be unhappy, so I began to wonder, what could I turn over to God that he couldn't louse up that would make her happy? And after about 3 days of concentration, I called her and I said, okay, I'm turning something over to God. She said, good. What are you turning over? I said, my ironing. She said, you're ironing? I said, well, you said it didn't matter. No. She said, that's all right. And I want you to know God don't like to iron either. Because I used to keep my ironing in a cabinet, just in case I got the urge. I turned it over to him. His swapped out of the cabinet, ended up in boxes. Eventually the boxes ended up in the rumpus. It was a mess. And every time she'd come over, I'd say, I want you to see the ironing. And that's when she'd give me routine number one. It's all right. So I figured if it don't bother her and it don't bother him, I will not let it bother me. But after an AA meeting in El Monte one night, this guy walks up and he says, Winnie, you got a bunch of kids, don't you? And I said, yes. I was admitting it by then. And he said, well, I go to an orphanage down in Mexico, and those little guys could sure use anything that possibly your kid's about grown. So I promised him faithfully I would go right home. I would arrange everything. He could just pick it up at his leisure. But I am a procrastinator by profession. He didn't follow me home by morning. I forgot he asked me. Now, sometime after that, and I'm not sure of the span of time, but I came home from an Al-Anon meeting one night, and Eddie said, Bill was by. He picked up the stuff for the orphanage. I said, he did? He said, yeah. I said, well, where did you find it? He said, those boxes in the rumpus room. Now, for those of you who have not put it together, he got my ironing. And I want you to know that from that day to this, I have no problems turning things over to God. Because my God, as I understand him today, has some of the most unique answers. I never would have thought of sending him to Mexico. And besides that, he made me look good. You know what I mean? Now, I don't tell that story to be blasphemous because I think this whole way of life is spiritual. But by the same token, I don't think God wants to listen to me cry for the rest of my life. I really don't think one of the prerequisites of a happy existence is counting the cracks on the sidewalk either. If you want my honest opinion, I think it kind of gives him a charge to hear me laugh and to know that finally I'm beginning to enjoy this life that he saw fit to give me. So I try to keep a light touch. Now, it don't work 100% of the time. That's all right. If he louses it up, I forgive him. You know, I went to Germany with my son Frank, who's very much like me, a few years ago, to visit my son Arthur, who was stationed over there. He's also like me. They're all like me. And when we got off the plane in Frankfurt, we couldn't speak the language. We didn't understand it. We didn't know where we were, where we were going. Just one of those classic situations that only someone of my caliber can get involved in, you know. And the first English words we heard, your luggage is lost. Yeah, well, my son Frank was in orbit before they finished the sentence. He said, what are we going to do? I said, we're going to be the first people through customs. And we were. And the next day we were in Berlin. The luggage was in Berlin. They even delivered it. So my conclusion was, God just didn't want to stop in Frankfurt, that's all. You see? Because all the worry in the world would not have brought that luggage back if I wasn't supposed to get it. But what it would do, could do, and has done in my life is rob me of the only thing that I have been given that I cannot replace, and that's time. You see, every second of every minute of every hour of every day that I spend worrying about things I know I can do nothing about, I have just spent the most precious gift I have, and I'll never get it back. So I try not to worry. which doesn't work 100% of the time either. But what I have today, thanks to places like this and people like you, is an awareness. An awareness that takes me right back to that first step where my sponsor, with her infinite wisdom, recognizing that I was allergic to the word alcohol, took it out of the first step and put my name in there. And she said, now work it. That's been quite a while ago. And yet as I stand here right this minute and I say, I'm powerless over Winnie and my life has become unmanageable. I may never get honest enough to tell you all the things that brings to my mind, but that's not the name of the game. The point is, it tells me who laughs up my life. It's not you, it's not him, it's not them, it's always me. Because you see, I wouldn't let you do to me today what I spent years doing to myself. If you tried to take away from me the pleasure of sitting on one of those darn hard benches at a Little League baseball game, I'd fight. And yet in my sickness and in my ignorance, I almost missed the whole thing. I am so grateful that God saw fit to make me one of the fortunate people that had a second chance. Because I want to live it to it to the utmost. Because not many of us get third chances. And that's why I am so grateful to be asked to come and meet new people who are walking down the same path that has meant so much to me. I'm going to close with a little poem that I use every time I talk, which may mean nothing to you, which is perfectly all right with me. I really didn't come out here to help you. I came out here to help me. And that ought to make somebody more comfortable. I don't know who they are. But my sponsor gave me this at a very low time in my life when my mother was very, very ill. And I knew there was nothing I could do, but I couldn't let go of it. I kept dealing and trying to get God to listen, to make some kind of a deal so that she would get better, even though I know it was impossible. And I guess Wilma took one look at my face and realized there were no words in her vocabulary that were going to bring me up out of this hole that I was having such fun in. And so she handed me this poem one day. And I remember the first time I read it, I had a mental picture of my kids. They used to come to me with their yo-yo. And they'd have the yo-yo clutched in that hand, and then they'd have the string attached to that one, and they'd say, come on, Mom, get the knot out of the middle, which was impossible, unless they handed me the yo-yo. And that's my shortcut today when I'm in a tight spot. If I can't have time for the whole poem, it's, please God, I got another knot in the string. But anyhow, it goes like this. As children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I took my broken dreams to God because he was my friend. But then, instead of leaving him in peace to work alone, I sort of hung around and tried to help with ways that were my own. At last, I snatched him back and cried, how can you be so slow? My child, he said, what could I do? You never did let go. So if I don't leave anything else here tonight as my gift to you, I hope you'll try to remember just one thing. If you can let go and let God and let the caring that we'll be sharing here this weekend be a part of your life one day at a time, you've got the recipe for a good day. Because God loves us in spite of all we think we've done. And we love each other in spite of all we think we've done. But you want to know why I love you? Because in my wildest dreams, I never could have found this way of life without places like this and people like you. Thank you for listening, and God bless.